Garest, and I hope I didn't mispronounce that, but I'm sure if I did, somebody will correct me. So counsel for that case can go ahead and set up. Before we get started, I'm sure counsel are aware of the rules, but we'll go over a few. 15 minutes aside, the appellant can attempt to reserve some time. However, that's going to be subject to our questioning, of course. You may run out of time and not be able to do that. We have read the briefs. At least one of us has read the record in the case, so it'd probably be a wise use of your time to go directly to the legal issues in the case, but the time is yours to spend as you want. With that, we're ready to proceed with the King case.
May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Drew Haywood, and I represent the plaintiff, Alexis King, in this matter. At stake in this case is the essence of protecting the right in a civil setting to a fair trial by a jury. This case, as far as I can tell, is an issue of first impression in Colorado, and as much as most of the cases dealing with juror misconduct, as we have here, are in a criminal setting. And this case is obviously a civil case, so this is an opportunity for this court to establish some guidelines in a civil setting regarding juror misconduct, specifically the issue of a sleeping juror.
Well, the first question I have is, confirm for me, yes or no, which way that the Mr. King's counsel did not bring the issue of the juror misconduct, the sleeping, until the end of the case, but yet the so-called misconduct occurred early on. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I didn't try the case at the trial court level.
I don't, but what's the record?
But from the record, the objection was made prior to deliberations. And
that wasn't my question, Mr. Haywood. When did the conduct occur to which he made an objection?
The conduct occurred during the presentation of direct evidence, what I would call the presentation of direct evidence.
Is that the first day of trial?
Sir?
Is that the first day of trial?
Your Honor, I'm not certain on that. And I'm not certain that the record tells us exactly when it is. The record is not as revealing as I would like to see, but it is what it is.
What happened during your client?
Are we supposed to find it out ourselves? Is that what your answer is?
What I would tell you is that the juror slept through the plaintiff's direct testimony in its entirety, which was at the beginning of the trial, and then two of the plaintiff's witnesses.
The problem I have, Mr. Haywood, with what you just said, and I think it's the principal issue in the case. You just said the juror slept through the entire plaintiff's testimony. The court found otherwise, didn't it?
No, sir, Your Honor. The court said, and I actually brought up a copy of the record if you'd like me to just to read the relevant portions, and it's pretty sparse, but in volume 7 of the trial.
No, we got it.
You've got it? Okay.
He said perhaps he and some of other jurors dozed off at one point or another. He was quick to add that it was nothing out of the ordinary, and the case got pretty boring for a while. That's the factual finding where we have to deal with on the record from the judge who was sitting there.
That's correct.
So is there any finding in the record anywhere that a juror slept through your client's entire testimony?
Our position, Your Honor, is that there is. And that's on lines on page 199, line 17. The plaintiff's counsel, starting at line 14, the plaintiff's counsel says, you know, the judge has just said, I didn't see anything that gave me pause. The plaintiff's counsel says, okay, well, I actually saw him physically with his head drooped down onto his chest, his papers in his lap, his hand hanging by his side, and the judge's quote is, okay, I am aware of that. And then just very shortly thereafter, the plaintiff's counsel in line 18 says, I saw a pen fall out of his hand. If that's not sound asleep, then I don't know what is. And the court in line 21 says that did happen. So Yes, the judge said, I didn't see anything that would...
Mr. Haywood, as I read the record, or have the record referred to, that the trial counsel, Mr. King, did not bring the issue to the court's attention when it first arose, which was on the so-called first day of trial. Now, is that correct or incorrect?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
That's from my reading of the record, that is correct. And the plaintiff's position is, despite the fact that perhaps if it were me trying the case, I would have raised it on the first day of trial, or perhaps if it was one of you all, you would have raised it on the first day of trial, the objection was nonetheless timely made because it was made prior to deliberations and plenty of time for the trial judge to remedy the situation.
Well, is there any reason, and you may not know, Mr. Haywood, and I understand, do you know of any reason, does the record reflect a reason why it wasn't raised?
It does not, Your Honor. The only thing I can, and this is sheer speculation, is that there was a tactical decision behind it, and perhaps plaintiff's counsel was afraid of pointing that out in the juror's presence, or perhaps he was afraid of what the, you know, if the juror was removed, what the jury might would think. And as the situation got progressively worse, he felt the need to bring it up. But as I mentioned, that's just speculation. What I'm trying to go on today is the record. And what we have on the record is, the reasonable inference from the record is that the juror was asleep. And
all right, well, Mr. Haywood, you said this is a case of first impression, but all the other misconduct cases, the jurors falling asleep and so forth, have been in connection with criminal cases. What's the difference?
Well,
tell me, now, what's the difference between, why shouldn't we follow the law as founded by the Colorado Supreme Court or other divisions of this court, the Court of Appeals, and apply the same rules as we do in criminal cases to this juror misconduct in the civil case?
I think this honorable court should apply the same law, and that's essentially the position I'm arguing today. Okay. There simply hasn't been an opportunity to establish that in a civil setting, and under Colorado rule, under CRCP 38, you've got a right to a trial by jury. Granted, it's not constitutionally protected in the same way that it is in a criminal case, but that's...
But haven't we said in those criminal, those juror misconduct cases in criminal, that it's up to the duty of the counsel to bring it to the court's attention at the earliest possible moment?
That's correct, Your Honor, and I would argue...
Why shouldn't we follow that rule?
But I think you should, and I think that was done in this case. And I think it was done,
first day of trial?
It wasn't done the first day of trial, but that doesn't...
Second day?
It wasn't done the second day of trial.
When?
It was done before jury deliberations.
That was after 4 days of trial.
And that's correct, Your Honor, but it was done in plenty of time for the judge to remedy the situation.
Well, you said that now that's the second time, and I assume your argument is he could have appointed the alternate at that point. Right.
Well, that, but more importantly, at the very least, he should have simply made an inquiry and said, hey, what's going on here?
But because he could have done that at the first day of trial. You've said now two or three times the judge is plenty of time to remedy it. Wouldn't the proper time to remedy the situation be when counsel noticed the juror is asleep through your client's testimony, which is, you know, probably the critical moment of that trial, to ask for a bench conference and have the judge inquire? I mean, the cases, both sides rely on the same cases, you know, involve situations where in some the judge asks. And it turns out, you know, the person had a migraine, so her eyes were closed, but she was awake. That's really the time to remedy, or the judge could have admonished the jury, you need to pay attention. And so isn't that the more appropriate time than after closing argument, right before the jury goes to deliberate?
You know, I would say that's when I would do it, but that's not when it happened in this case. And the argument that the defendant makes is the proper time is not after a verdict has been rendered and all of that, and they cite the tramway case. The problem with the tramway case that the defendant is citing is that it's inapplicable to the facts in this present case for two reasons. One, because in tramway, the juror didn't fall asleep. It was an interruption of a counsel during a closing argument, and that's a vastly different scenario. But more importantly, in the tramway case, the objection wasn't raised until after trial, and that's not what happened here. We, of course, made post-trial motions and submitted affidavits, and it's really not even worth getting into the affidavits because those came after the trial. But what is relevant is that in this particular case, the objection wasn't waived, and it was made when the judge could have said, okay, let's do an inquiry and ask the juror what's going on here, and that didn't happen.
Let me ask Mr. Hayward, in terms of the case law, again, it seems both sides are relying on the same cases. Just as a general rule, would you agree with me that the cases seem to say we should defer to what the trial judge finds regarding whether the juror was asleep or not? That seems to be, to me, to be the pattern, but I'd like you to, if you disagree, I'd like to hear it.
No, I think the case law says that obviously we give deference to the trial judge, absent an abuse of discretion, but that's what has happened here. In the plaintiff's, that's the plaintiff's argument, is that it was an abuse of discretion, and the trial, you know, that discretion on the part of the trial judge was an abuse, because the trial judge should have first made an inquiry when the objection was raised, and he didn't do that, especially in light of his supposedly corroborating the plaintiff's counsel's statements when he says, okay, I'm aware of that, and that did happen.
Well, the record suggests that's a little vague. I mean, he's aware of that could mean he's aware the pencil fell on the floor, or he's aware the guy put his head down.
I mean, that's
not, the judge never said, I'm aware he's asleep. When the judge said, I'm aware of that, what he said was, you know, his response to trial counsel's statement that he had his head down and he dropped his pencil. But then the same trial judge who was acknowledging that said, some of the jurors dozed at times, nothing unusual. Don't we have to give a lot of weight to that finding?
I think that I would argue that that's not even a finding, especially in light of these conflicting statements that were given. And therein lies the problem, is that you have two statements that are so conflicting that the trial judge should have said, okay, let's ask a few questions and see what went on here. And that never happened.
The trial counsel asked the judge to inquire. I can't recall.
The trial counsel said, I believe he simply made a motion to replace the juror. And again, it's sort of bizarre the way the record reads, because what happened is he, you know, and I'm fairly certain that trial counsel probably didn't know exactly what the law was on that, made the objection, said, okay, let's figure out what to do with this. And then the trial judge just sort of meanders off, and there's some sort of joke cracked about the judge sleeping, and then they just never address it. There's never a ruling where the trial judge says, you know, this is denied, here's why. There's a, you know, the statement, well, I didn't see anything that gave me serious pause. When you couple that with the statements the judge made saying, okay, I'm aware of that and I saw that, the plaintiff argues that the only reasonable inference is that the juror was asleep. And even if the juror wasn't asleep, there's a duty to do an inquiry here. And that's, we've provided case law.
4 days after the event happened?
Pardon me?
I say 4 days after the event happened.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Your argument then focuses in on the question that the trial judge abused his discretion, correct? What about the plaintiff's counsel, Mr. King's counsel, inviting error by not bringing this to the court's attention for 4 days?
Well, I would simply say again that he perhaps should have raised it earlier, and I would have if it were me, but it wasn't me, and it was raised before deliberations, before the comeback of the verdict.
I understand that. You mentioned that several times. I finally got the impression that it was raised before deliberations. Go ahead. But isn't that an invited error?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the case law is not specific enough regarding timeliness, and the case that the defendant cited isn't particularly applicable to the facts in this particular case. The only case that they've cited is this Tramway case. They cited the Murray case, which, you know, and I may be wrong, but I read the Murray case, and it was not dealing with juror misconduct or sleeping jurors. It was some sort of issue about a promissory note, and I can only assume that was included by an error. But the only case that they've cited says it should be raised timely, and while perhaps I would have raised the issue sooner, I think it was raised in a sufficient amount of time to preserve the objection, and in a sufficient amount of time for the judge to have, at the very least, made an inquiry. And because of that, there was a prejudice to the plaintiff.
Mr. Hayward, would you agree that the other side here took issue with the trial counsel's argument that the juror was asleep?
Well, of course I would agree with that.
So they made a record that, no, he wasn't asleep, I was watching him, whatever else. So we have a conflict. I mean, your side said juror's asleep, the other side says not asleep, correct?
Correct.
And I mean, isn't it true that in every case where there's conflicting evidence, King, there was a conflict, I think, Herrera, Thurman, you know, the court ultimately makes that call, right?
That's correct, but those situations were different from this case, because in this case, you have what very strongly appear to me to be the corroborating statements of the judge. Obviously, it's a he said, she said, or he said, he said, with respect, no offense, with respect to what happened and what didn't happen. And you know, they cite the Thurman case, but the big difference in the Thurman case is that you had independent witnesses that had conflicting testimony, and we don't have that here. The only thing we have is what the two counsels said and then what the trial judge said, and in this case, it appears that the trial judge corroborated that.
So then that really is the heart of your argument. Your view is the judge kind of made findings that this jury was asleep, and we should be deferring to that.
That's correct.
What rule do we adopt if we were to conclude the judge's statements were ambiguous? What do we do then?
Then a rule needs to be adopted similar to the cases that we've cited in our supplemental authority, which are more clear, which state that anytime you have this situation, there is a duty of inquiry. Not necessarily in every case of juror misconduct, but there's a duty of inquiry, especially in a case like this where you have a juror that's alleged to have been asleep. And after doing that duty of inquiry, there needs to be a determination as to whether or not the case was prejudiced. Not materially prejudiced, but as we stated in the briefs, possibility of prejudice. And if that possibility of prejudice exists, then the juror needs to be removed and replaced with an alternate juror. So.
Thank you, Mr. Haywood. Your time is up.
May it please the court, counsel. I don't think that there's any.
What's your name?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. My name is Stuart Jorgensen.
Say
I'm
that again.
Stuart Jorgensen. I'm the counsel for the appellee, and I was also the trial counsel for the defendant.
Thank you.
And I should make one reference to the court as well. We tried changing the name to his real name. His name is Garrett. We've referred to him as Garrist just because apparently it takes an act of the Supreme Court to get the name changed in the trial court level.
I actually noticed that, counsel, on the briefs. I think at least the briefs were consistent. Thank you for calling it to our attention.
If Mr. Garrett's going to make good law or bad law, at least maybe we can spell his name right. The points I want to start out with is that we start out with two presumptions. One is that we presume the trial court exercised his discretion correctly. We also start out with the other presumption, don't we, that the juror or the jury exercised their duty correctly. And it falls upon the appellant to show otherwise. And in this case, there just isn't sufficient evidence in the record to show, number one, that there was an abuse of discretion at any level. But with that standard, there's insufficient evidence to show that the judge determined that a juror was sleeping. It's equivocal. It's conflicted. Number two is there's no evidence to show that there was some actual prejudice or even potential prejudice, because there's no showing by the appellant that, number one, certain testimony was missed while a juror was allegedly sleeping. Number two is that evidence was critical in one fashion or another. Or three, given the fact that there were 10 expert witnesses in this trial, and given the fact that we stipulated to the admissibility of the doctor's opinions and reports, isn't it cumulative anyhow? What prejudice is there? And there's no offer of proof, no statement at any point saying we were hurt potentially because of this. And then finally.
Well, I guess, I mean, we have, and I recognize there are timing issues. There's the affidavit from the plaintiff's uncle, I guess, and private counsel after that said the juror slept through the entire, you know, most of the plaintiff's case and one of our experts. Let's accept for a minute the cumulative argument you make, mm-hmm. but hypothetically, if the argument was timely raised, and I'm not making a conclusion either way, but let's say for argument's sake, it was timely raised and the evidence presented that the juror slept through the entire plaintiff's case, wouldn't that be prejudice per se?
Hypothetically?
Yes.
Perhaps.
Okay.
Perhaps. But it falls upon the trial court to weigh the totality of the circumstances, because the trial judge is authorized and given the power to observe not only what is happening on the record, but what's happening off the record. And that's why we empower the trial judges at this trial level to have that kind of discretion. But that brings up the third point as well, Your Honor, is that we were denied...
Before you get to the third point, I want to ask you about this timeliness issue.
Yes, sir.
While we have time. In the Denver Tramway case, as your opponent points out, the motion or the objection to the misconduct wasn't made until after the trial. So there you had deliberations, you had a verdict. And at that point, of course, you can't really cure the prejudice. It's too late. That's clearly too late. But here, the objection was made before there were any deliberations and before mm-hmm. a verdict. And so, and you have an alternative juror just sitting right there who's heard all the same evidence. Nobody contends that juror was asleep. So why, as a practical matter, wasn't this objection timely with respect to this potential juror?
If I made two things on that, Your Honor. One is because if the objection was made, and it was certainly made after all the evidence, after everything was done, after the closings were made, and we're referring back, and my brief refers and cites to the record exactly what happened during those 4 days. If we try to go back to that first day, 4 days later, and say, well, were you sleeping? It becomes the memory of counsel. It becomes the memory of the judge. The opportunity for me as a trial counsel for the defendant is lost because I can't ask that juror, did you hear that? Or, Your Honor, may I approach for a minute? I'm a little bit concerned about this juror over here. Or, Your Honor, can we at least allow the jurors to stand up and stretch? We've been here for a long time. There are all sorts of possible solutions short of any kind of in-camera inquiry to find out, and that was denied us. And I can't, 4 days later, recreate the events the judge saw at that time. That's why we have to rely upon the judge. If the juror comes, if we have a voir dire, the juror says, oh yeah, I was sleeping and I had no idea what the plaintiff was saying, well then, yeah, kick that juror off and plug in the alternate. But that's not what we have here, of course. And then also, there is another case. It's the Herrera case that talks about a timely objection. It's actually the Herrera case, which is cited for other purposes here as well. On page 240, keynote 18, talks about if there is no contemporaneous objection, then the appeal is limited to plain error. I think that applies. Plain error. If no timely objection, Your Honor, then the appeal is limited to plain error. And if I may just grab my water for a second.
What we're trying to figure out, at least in part, is whether it was timely. Okay, so before we get to the issue of whether we apply plain error, we have to determine whether the objection is timely. And my question goes to the timeliness, and why isn't it timely if it occurs before deliberations and before a verdict?
Well, we've lost the contemporaneous observations and the ability to build a record right then and there. We are now relying upon memory instead of actual facts and observations by the court and by counsel. We are also relying upon the memory of the juror to go back 4 days. And also we are creating, inadvertently perhaps, I'm not accusing any counsel of doing this, but if we wait that long, there are two inferences that could possibly be drawn from it. One, it wasn't an incident in the first place. It wasn't bad enough to even warrant bringing it to the court's attention. Or number two, as suggested, not on this case perhaps, but suggested by counsel for appellant, it could be a tactical reason. And I don't believe that we have room in this kind of matter for a tactical reason to wait 4 days to see how the trial progresses. I think we have to bring it up right then and there. Otherwise, we lose the timeliness. We lose all the benefits of bringing it up right away. We lose all the tools available to us to either discover whether there was a problem or to cure it right then and there.
Well, I think we can all agree that, and I think your counsel has agreed, it would be better practice to raise this issue as soon as it comes up. But by raising it when it was raised here, mm-hmm. it seems to me the worst that could have happened, the worst, is that an alternate juror sits on deliberation, somebody whom both parties have agreed could decide this case if necessary. So what's the harm to your client by virtue of having this alternate juror as opposed to this other juror in the deliberations?
If, in fact, this juror violated his oath and was guilty of malfeasance, and we were able to determine that with a timely or not so timely or untimely objection, if, number one, we could show that the jury was actually sleeping instead of in a power think or something. And number two, if we can show that the juror actually missed more than a few moments of testimony, then I agree that juror should be kicked off. But it becomes harder and harder and harder and harder if we wait 10 minutes, an hour, a day, 2 days, 4 days. It becomes almost impossible after 4 days. And therefore, that's why it's not timely.
Can you react, Mr. Jorgensen, to your colleague's argument that the judge, I guess your colleague says the judge made findings the juror was asleep, or at least there's an inference the judge noticed that there may be an issue. I'd be interested in your take on that piece of it, and then related to Judge Jones's question, when there is at least a question, I mean, it seemed like the judge had some question, shouldn't the alternate have been appointed at that point? Even if it was 4 days after it happened, the judge seemed to remember it.
If there is a question, don't we still have to give the benefit of the doubt, number one, to the juror, unless there's enough information to prove otherwise? And don't we also have to give the benefit of the doubt to the judge, who is engaged in a process of questioning whether or not this juror was asleep? And ultimately, he decided, if not on this page, in his order for the post-trial relief on the ruling of that, number one, perhaps the juror fell asleep. That's the issue. There was arguments that he did. There are arguments that he didn't, and the judge said perhaps. And at the very most, his ruling, which you'll find on his verbal ruling, which you'll find in volume 7, page 199, even if you read it in a light most favorable to the appellant and say that the juror had his head down, the juror appeared to have his eyes closed, or even did have his eyes closed, that the juror had papers on his lap with his hand on his lap and didn't bother retrieving a pen. There are a number of reasonable explanations for it. I don't mean to pick on her, but two arguments ago, this young lady with the pink shirt, I know she was awake, but her head was down. She wasn't moving. She had papers in her lap. She had her hand on her lap. I guess you could interpret or conclude that she was asleep. But I concluded that she was working and thinking about the arguments. And if she had dropped the pen, or if one of your honors had dropped the pen during the argument, I'm quite certain that you wouldn't be crawling underneath the bench looking for it while the arguments were going on. There's a matter of decorum that was there as well. I looked at this juror, I looked at all the jurors, and my conclusion, for whatever it's worth, was that the trial was long, was hard, because there's so many witnesses. But I didn't conclude any fell asleep.
Mr. Juries, what has the Supreme Court, Colorado Supreme Court, or the other divisions of this court said in the past about the timeliness of relating to counsel bringing to the attention of the court misconduct or sleepiness or whatever it is of the juror? What have we said about that already?
Well, Herrera, as I mentioned, said that it needs to be timely, otherwise it's just
what is it? What did Herrera mean by the word timely?
Let me double check, Your Honor. Herrera said contemporaneous.
All right, thank you. Anything further?
Well, the others there are almost a dichotomy of cases, those dealing with sleeping or alleged sleeping, and those dealing with an outside influence such as a Bible or a dictionary. But and there may be a distinction there, but on the ones that have to deal with sleeping, where the judge is particularly well suited to judge that, there was one and only one where the judge was overturned, and that was the Evans matter, where there was no contemporaneous objection, but during the closing arguments, the judge looked over and saw that a juror was having a hard time sleeping. This was a criminal case. He sent his bailiff over there to the juror and gave the juror a glass of water. The juror drank the water and had a bit more difficult time sleeping. His head was revolving in a sleeping-like manner, like he was on the edge of sleep. And take that back on the revolving head. I think I crossed the case. But after the trial was over, they took the verdict. The judge took the verdict and accepted it as a guilty plea. And afterwards, he opened a contempt proceeding against that juror and found him in contempt of court. Clear finding that the juror not only sleeping and guilt, but also guilty of malfeasance. There was no objection at all, but the judge made a contemporaneous observation for the record. But there's nothing in the record quite frankly, there is nothing to indicate other than contemporaneous that the objection has to be made right away.
When was the, refresh my recollection, the Herrera case, who decided that and when?
Both cited it in their, the appellant cited it in their...
No, I'm not, when, but when was it decided?
Oh, decided, sir. 1999, Colorado Appellate Court.
Thank you. A division of this court. Yes.
I'm assuming so, yes.
Yes, quite. Thank you.
Don't have much time left. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions, but in short, I wanted to stress that while the judge did say, both verbally in the court, that perhaps the juror fell asleep, he never concluded that the juror fell asleep. There's indicia, but there was counter-indicia, and the totality of circumstances, the judge in the court level said, volume 8, page 199, I didn't see any behavior that I feel was really out of the ordinary or uncommon or of a such a nature to give me serious pause. That's pretty clear. And then in his written order, volume 2 in the record, page 345, the court finds that plaintiff's counsel has failed to show the allegations of a sleeping juror, not that the juror was actually sleeping, on this case resulted in improper influence in deliberations. The next thing, the court also went on to talk about how there was there's no basis upon which to conclude that there were any changes, whether actual or potential, to the actual outcome of this trial. Number one, we don't have an offer of proof as to what was missed. Number two, we don't have, before I forget, keep in mind that on the plaintiff testified twice, both at the beginning and at the end. And also, one expert that they're talking about was testifying by phone. There is no possibility of eye contact at all for that. It's audio only. And the other one was testifying by videotape. Absolutely no possibility or likelihood of eye contact either. And there's
Thank
no
you, Mr.
reason.
Mr. Jorgensen, your time's up.
I appreciate the opportunity, Your Honor.
Case will stand submitted. The opinion will issue in due course. That is the